Welcome to the Punch and Judy Show. This is your host, Judy Berry, talking about a revolution. The revolution, of course, is still going on in Headwaters as it was before, and we'll be talking about that a little bit today. I'm going to stick to the regular format today, though, which is that the first half hour of the show, or at least until 12:30, will be open call-in on any subject you want to. And the phone number is 895-2448, so feel free kind of to make this your bulletin board for local events and comments or anything, and it looks like we've got one already. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy, this is Hawk.
Hey, Hawk.
Yeah, I have a bulletin board kind of thing. We're going to have a benefit for Headwaters tonight at the Wussifoot Gallery in Casper on the coast here, and it starts at 7:30. It's a sliding scale admission from $4 on up to anything you want to lay on the door. 50s, 100s are fine. And the lineup is going to be some local performers, Annie Rose, Antonia Lamb might come and play a couple songs, myself with percussionist Nathan and Anderson from Albion, local poets Teresa Whitehill and Leonard Serino, and then after the kind of acoustic-y, poet-y kind of beginning, we're going to clear the chairs out of there and dance with the Brown Brothers Blues Band. So that's going to benefit Headwaters, and it's tonight at 7:30 at Wussifoot Gallery in Casper.
Okay, that sounds great, Hawk. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Okay, one other thing, Judy?
Sure.
We're still taking donations for Covelo. They still have their camp outside the office there, the tribal council office, the traditionals, and they're going to maintain a presence there until the elections in November when they hope to have a more community-based tribal council put in there. So if people still want to support that, too, that's another important thing that's going on, too. So.
Okay, well, we'll be having Dennis Jennings on later in the show. He's the paralegal for Tony Serra, and we'll be talking about that.
Great. That sounds excellent.
Okay.
It's going to be on.
Great.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Okay, we got another call. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. It's Antoinette.
Hi, Antoinette. Can I ask you to hold on a minute? Because you guys started calling so fast, I didn't get to do the underwriting. So just hold on.
Right ahead. I'll hang on.
Okay. So anyway, the Punch and Judy Show is brought to you in part by our members in the Mendocino Environmental Center, a membership organization located on Stanley Street near the courthouse in Ukiah. Their number is 468-1660. And take it away, Antoinette.
Yes, well, this Sunday afternoon at Bauer Park, which is up behind Wallala on Old Stage Road, and anybody in Wallala will be happy to give you directions as to how to find Bauer Park, Michela Alioto is going to be out here between 1 and 5 in the afternoon at Bauer Park, and it's freebie as far as anybody coming and meeting and speaking with her is concerned. She will give her speech at 2:30 in the afternoon. Now, there's going to be raffle tickets for art which is being donated by local painters and artists, including three paintings by Tim Sheets, whose name everybody knows, and other good artists here. There's going to be beer and wine, and the Oyster Brothers are going to be there for those that are fond of oysters. And there's going to be a barbecue. Half price is $4, and full price is $8 on the barbecue dinner. And there's going to be dancing and, of course, plenty of music, and I'm sure lots of fun because the crowd that gathers at Bauer Park is a very alive crowd. And we'd just love to have people come from all over the county. After all, she is taking the trouble to come clear out here to our particular neck of the woods off the beaten highway, and we think she deserves a warm welcome, and we also think it's a great opportunity for educating her on how we feel about environmental matters.
Okay, that sounds great. I actually got another phone call on, so I'm going to move on, okay? Thanks a whole lot. Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Yes, I just called to say that Michela Alioto is on the record as being against any logging operations in the ancient forests. She's on the record as being against the salvage timber logging, and she's on the record as saying that the agreement is inadequate, the Headwaters agreement is inadequate because it does not include environmentalists and it does not include workers. and we need to get her elected, get the electorate energized, get her elected, and hold her to her promises. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. All right, so, well, that's a fast start here today. I haven't even gotten my breath yet. But anyway, keep on calling in if you want to, 895-2448. I'll tell you a few things in the meantime, though, is, of course, you know, we've just had a week of just some really incredible actions out there in Headwaters, and one of which, I think the most spectacular one, was the lockdown in All Species Grove, which was, it's the place where they're salvage logging, where they had that very ugly picture of it, actually very good picture of a very ugly logging job on the front page of the Press Democrat, and this is the second largest old growth grove. And, you know, the woods are crawling with cops these days. It's not so easy to get in. Yet 30 people got all the way into the deep woods, and I guess this was on Monday of last week, and they found a place. I think it was a bridge. We'll find out later when somebody calls in from that demo. But at any rate, they blocked up the equipment going in at a bottleneck, and 30 people sat down in the road, and then 6 people chained themselves to logging equipment. Well, I want to say most of them are out of jail. There's a few that are still getting out of jail this morning. We've had 45 people in jail last week, which was a kind of an all-time record, and I'm sure they're very sick of us, but as I'm sure we are of them, at least in those who are in jail. At any rate, what I want to say about this is that one of the people who locked down to one of those bulldozers is a man from, well, it's named Howard, who is an ex-logger, a recent ex-logger, who's been kind of working with us for years, but not in such a prominent position. And I hope that he'll come on the show next week. But, you know, I think that that's very incredible. He stood up at the Board of Forestry meeting in March last year and said that when they were talking about, you know, they wanted to cut the road into Headwaters, and we packed the Board of Forestry meeting, and they ended up voting against it. And when it was his turn to speak, he stood up and said, well, I'm a logger, and we loggers are tired of cutting ourselves out of jobs. So I'm really glad we have people like that in our community, and I really think that emphasizes the importance of why this needs to be a community-based movement if we're ever going to get anywhere. Anyway, so we had that demo last week. We also had one on Saturday, all these since my last show, which was, you know, they already had 22 people in jail, I guess, by then, and I'm sure they didn't expect another demo. But on Saturday, people blockaded the Fisher Gate, the large gate where everybody got arrested in the big demo, and that's the main gate going into Headwaters. And at that blockade at the Fisher Gate, there were 8 people arrested that were locked into the barrels, and then 2 people that were just kind of grabbed out of the crowd, LP style, for those of you in Albion, and what, you know, take him, and you know, these are people we've seen in the past as the security for Pacific Lumber. These are people we saw in Owl Creek, whatever. Well, one of them turned out to be a photographer named Scott Stewart, who is a freelance photographer who has sold pictures to the Japanese news agency, and in fact has taken photographs of the royal family for Royalty magazine. So he was in jail with the rest of the riffraff, and I suppose he's out now and has a story to tell. One of the other things that we found out during this was that the women had to be released early. And the reason the women had to be released early is, although they have this big, fat, new jail for the men, they only have the old jail for the women, and the new section isn't open yet, so they don't have as much room. So we began to think, well, gee, I guess it's time for a women's demo then in that case. And we got out the calendar to look to see what might be a good day for a women's demo. And there, staring us in the face, was the date of October 31st, Halloween night. And, I mean, this is a brand new idea. It has not been run by people and consensed on or anything. But I'd be really interested in hearing from particularly some of the women in our community how you would feel about having a women's demo at Headwaters on, you know, on Halloween. I mean, it's their worst night. It's the cops' worst night of the year, and we could be their worst nightmare. Have a call, so I'll take this. Caller on the air.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I was there Monday night for the demonstration.
Uh-huh.
And I think a women's demo is definitely in call. And that we need to pack that jail with women singing for that forest.
Which demo? You were there for the All Species demo?
Yes.
And you want to tell us a little bit about it?
I wasn't in jail for it. I was vaguely involved. And those people are working so hard. And they need fresh new energy in there. And they need energy from down south here. They need food. They need rain gear, and they need all the support that we can give from down here.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Do you got anything else?
No, that's it.
Okay.
Save Headwaters now.
All right.
Bye.
Yeah, that is certainly a good point. I mean, it's, you know, it poured down rain last night, and there's still people camping out. The base camp has moved again because we're only allowed to stay in each place for 2 weeks at a time. So we're back at Swimmer's Delight, which is kind of the best one, I think. At least that's my personal opinion, which is up in Carlotta. So anyone who's interested in going up, not only that, people need fresh. I mean, people are exhausted. We've been doing this for a solid month. And just because people are exhausted doesn't mean they're not still doing it. They are. And there are indeed fresh people coming in and out, and there's some rotation. There's also just incredible people that have been there the whole time, that have not budged, that have kept doing actions no matter what. And it's getting colder and colder up there. Last time I was up there, last Wednesday, it felt like the beginning of winter instead of the end of summer. And people really do need things like, you know, additional, you know, tarps and rain gear and tents and anything to keep warm. It's getting really cold up there, and it's very impressive that people are still doing this. Unfortunately, we don't know of any time that the logging is supposed to be ending. So, and actually, we should be getting a call from Epic sometime during the show, and maybe we'll get some more information from them about that. But in the meantime, the other problem, of course, is that we've been going so long that we're getting very, very broke. So if anybody can help out, I know people have been doing this for a long time, and it's getting boring to hear it, but that's why it's needed all the more than ever now. At the beginning, when the whole world was excited about it, then there was stuff pouring in, but the level of donations has fallen off, and the need has really increased because people are putting their bodies on their line and the line and doing just the most awesome, incredible actions in the world. So if anybody can help either with any kind of donations or food or, you know, tarps, all that stuff, or, of course, money, then please call 468-1660. And if you're interested in that, they can help you. Okay, so anyway, well, the other thing that I was getting to that I hope I can get in before we hear from Epic is that you know, in the middle of all this, with just boom, 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 action after action, the Humboldt sheriff has actually been pretty open about it. He says, we're exhausted. You know, we want this to end. We're really tired of this. We've spent $1 zillion. They're calling for federal aid and all that kind of stuff. But we haven't heard a lot from the politicians. I mean, you know, they complained and they expressed their feigned shock that Charles Hertz was salvage logging in the very place that they gave him permission to log in. But other than that, we haven't heard much. Well, this week, I guess it was Wednesday, 2 days ago, Dianne Feinstein actually met with some people from the Headwaters Forest Coordinating Committee. And that's what I'm hoping to get a report in. They're supposed to be calling it in. If they don't, I can kind of ad lib it, but we'll hope we can get it firsthand from them. At any rate, I certainly wasn't invited to that meeting, I can tell you that. One of the things that happened at that meeting, though, was that somebody locked down outside the meeting. And I have to say, I had to laugh. I mean, it was like, it's driving me crazy, these individual actions. It's, you know, people seem to have a hard time with collectivism or the idea of a collective strategy. And I do think that individual initiative is great. And I think that decentralization is great. But what happened actually is that somebody came in from Davis and did an action in the Bay Area without asking anybody what else was going on that day. And it turned out just by coincidence, it was right when Cecilia and others were meeting with DiFi, which caused some slight problems. Anyway, we got a call. So, okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Judy. This is Cecilia calling in from Epic.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. I already kind of promoted what you were going to be talking about, that you had this meeting with Dianne Feinstein on Wednesday. So why don't you tell us what happened?
Well, yes, we did have a meeting, and it was somewhat disappointing. I don't feel that we have any new commitments from the senator. I do feel that one thing that she seemed concerned about was getting the background information on how they're operating in the under the salvage, and she seems concerned about whether or not the laws are being enforced. So we're doing some follow-up with that to provide her with the information that we're going to have in front of the court on Tuesday. But she doesn't seem to feel that there's anything she can do to get a moratorium in place besides keep asking Hurwitz, who has thus far refused any, you know, budging an inch on either including the other groves in a moratorium or in stopping the salvage logging that's presently underway.
Does she understand why people are so upset with this deal?
Yeah, she seems to have some understanding of it. I don't think that she has a full understanding of it, so we intend to put the memo together that, you know, clearly outlines what's wrong with habitat conservation plans and, you know, on and on, our list of grievances about the deal itself. She really doesn't seem to feel that it's in her power to stop the logging. In the meantime, although she did seem to indicate that she understood that that really created a problem for people who, you know, are being asked to look forward and try to do something on a habitat plan. But in the meantime, with the logging occurring, that there's obvious loss of habitat happening at the same time that this planning process is supposed to be going on, and then that's going to definitely be a problem. She feels that Pete Wilson is the one who has some kind of power right now to do something about, one, the fact that the Board of Forestry is missing a seat, which could potentially throw a vote in favor of stopping the salvage logging in ancient redwoods, and two, that there may be some potential that he could have an effect on possibly an emergency order under his own authority as governor.
Do you know that? Does he have that authority? I've heard that he does.
Well, we have to research that. In fact, both things need to be looked into. We've heard that there is a nomination process possibly underway for the vacant seat on the Board of Forestry, but of course we've all tried that one before.
Right.
Years ago, trying to get people, real expert grassroots folks, you know, from the forest areas, such as, you know, Eric Swanson was one of the people I remember that was nominated in the past, and we've suggested other really qualified people, and that's never really gotten anywhere. So, but I think
One of the things in the Board of Forestry is that the seats are divided up: industry representatives, representatives of the public, etc. The open seat, which of those categories does it go to?
That's something that we're going to have to determine. I don't know what it is right now. I do know that the two votes that were against us were both timber industry seats. One thing that we did find out in our research about whether we could challenge the vote, the 4-2 vote needing a 5 affirmative votes in order to pass the rule,
right,
was the reason, one of the reasons that they constructed the votes that way was to prevent a block of the timber industry and ranching seats. So I think there are 3 industry seats and 1 ranching seat. So in order to prevent a 4 votes passing rules, they required the 5th vote.
Oh, okay. That doesn't look very encouraging.
No, it doesn't. But we're going to look into what kind of seat is available and put some information out to people on that. And then also, we have to research whether Wilson has the authority to issue a suspension in an emergency, but we can look back, I think it was almost a year and a half ago, when he suspended the California Endangered Species Act because of flooding, which was supposedly caused by an endangered species down in the Central Valley that didn't even exist.
Yeah, they do that. Those endangered species, they're always causing floods and earthquakes and things.
Right. Supposedly, an emergency was declared because of the flood, and they blamed it on this a salamander, which didn't even exist in this particular watershed, but it was because people had failed to remove the riparian vegetation because it was supposed to be habitat for this endangered species, and therefore that was the reason why it flooded. It was because, you know, they hadn't cleared the naturally occurring vegetation out of the stream. So it remains to be seen whether that's going to work. Of course, they're all long shots at this point.
Well, let me ask you another question about DiFi. How was her demeanor? Was she, like, angry or just cold or friendly? What was she?
She was friendly and sincere, and she did express that she had spent a great deal of energy at the end of these negotiations. I mean, she was brought in at the very end, and she did express that she spent a great deal of time trying to convince Hurwitz that these other groves were vitally important. In fact, she coined the term lesser cathedrals.
Yeah, that one's a pretty funny one.
For these groves, and, you know, and what we'd heard previously was that she did go to bat for those other groves, and 2 major problems stood in the way. 1, Hurwitz. 2, the price Hurwitz wants for this forest and for any part of this forest.
And 3, the lack of the government's will to enforce their laws against him so that he doesn't have so much bargaining power.
Exactly. Well, and she did mention that it was, again, inappropriate for those negotiators to pressure the FDIC or the OTS to, you know, force a debt for nature, but then I questioned and asked, well, if it's inappropriate for you to, it certainly isn't inappropriate for the public as taxpayers to keep pressuring the FDIC, and she actually agreed with us on that.
All right, well, great. So she give us an assignment. I have one more question for you. We have another caller trying to get in, and I'm going to try to grab them. So caller, hold on, and if you get hung up, call right back. But at any rate, I want to ask you, are they allowed to salvage log past, now the logging season ends November 15th or when it gets too rainy or something like that, and I know in winter operations and timber harvest plants they have to rock the roads and stuff like that, and from my understanding they're not doing that in all species or anything like that. Are they allowed to salvage log in the winter, and if so, do they have to follow any rules like rocking the roads?
Well, that's a good question, and it seems to me that most of the people involved in creating this deal, from Feinstein to Garamendi to Katie McGinty, and even John Campbell yesterday was trying to tell Channel 2 that they were going to be off limits for the salvage operations as of November 15th.
Oh, we hope so.
That's not true as far as we can read. Tracy Cattleman is a registered forester, and she's been digging out the code on the winter operations here at the office today. And really what it is there's a winter period between November 15th to April 1st. And what that does is sets up a yardstick for what they're supposed to be looking at, what their operations would be during the winter period. And the way we read it, when the soil has reached a saturated condition, that's the trigger for preventing certain operations. But it is not something that is restricted per se under the salvage logging or even timber harvest plans, because often timber harvest plans have an exemption during the winter operations. So,
yeah, but nonetheless, they still, what I've seen, they do have the exemption, but they still have to do more stuff. Well, anyway, I'm going to have to move on because this caller's been trying really hard. I really appreciate you calling in and giving us that update.
Hey, let's hope they're not in the forest today at any rate.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Cecilia Lehman of EPIC, and caller, you're on the air.
Hello, Judy?
Yes.
This is Dennis.
Oh, good. I'm so glad it's you. Okay, well, this first half hour of the show has been so jam-packed, I didn't even get a chance to introduce you or say what you're going to be talking about. So why don't you start by telling people who you are?
Am I on the air?
Oh, yeah, you are.
Oh, well, this is Dennis Jennings, and I'm an Oklahoma Indian, but I work for some attorneys in a case in Mendocino County involving Eugene Bear Lincoln, who's currently in the Ukiah, in the Mendocino County Jail. The background of this case, many people in Mendocino know. We have about a 75% recognition rate of people in Mendocino County that know about the case. And I'm sure that your listeners, Judy, know about this case.
Yeah, we've certainly covered it as much as we can.
And but it dates back to three homicides that occurred in the Round Valley Indian Reservation outside of Covelo on April 14th, 1995. So we're preparing a defense and preparing for trial for Bear Lincoln, and trial will start on the 3rd of February. They're going to start selecting a jury in Mendocino County. We're having a lot of activities next week involved with Bear Lincoln. Bear Lincoln, in fact, in the 24th, I believe, is Thursday next week, he goes to court. And he goes to court with his nephew, Winter Hawk Lincoln. What has happened is that the prosecution has attempted to keep Bear Lincoln's nephew, Winter Hawk Lincoln, in jail for months until the trial to ensure his attendance. And both the prosecutor and law enforcement, they violated a court order because they interviewed Winter Hawk Lincoln while he was in juvenile custody. So we're waiting for a decision by the juvenile court judge in the misconduct of both the prosecution and law enforcement.
Well, let me back up on that a little bit. So Winter Hawk was in jail for something separate, not having to do with Bear Lincoln's case, and he was interrogated about Bear Lincoln without a lawyer or anyone present. Is that correct?
That's true, because the judge in the juvenile court had actually made an order, and that order was violated. It was acknowledged that it was violated by investigator Roy Gorley in court, and in under Judge Luther in Bear Lincoln's court. And then the prosecutor, Aaron Williams, and the investigator stood before a juvenile court judge to show cause why they violated a court order. And then we're waiting for the juvenile court judge to make a decision in that misconduct, and then Judge Luther makes the decision about Bear's case in Winter Hawk Lincoln. So that will be next Thursday in court in Ukiah.
And what time is that hearing?
I believe it's at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Have people been coming? Since Headwater started, I haven't had time to come to any of the hearings. Have people been coming, and are you still wanting people to keep coming?
We especially encourage Native Americans to see how the so-called justice system works. And we've had a lot of activity from Bear's relatives and from people of the Round Valley Reservation and other the local community Native Americans. But then again, the non-Indian community has responded very well. There's people on the coast have come over all the time, and a lot of people have come to court just about every time. It's a lot more significant than the Mendocino County wants to kind of keep all this information under wraps because of police misconduct and sloppy police work, and because of some of the vindictive kind of activities that they have against the attitudes about the Native American community. But then again, we want people to see how this system works, and especially we think it's important for Bear Lincoln and the rest of the Native Americans in Mendocino County to reflect on the decisions that are made in his case. And we like people to come to court. Yes, we encourage that.
I think one of the problems is people aren't really up on, you know, what's happening, when the hearings are, or anything like that. So, you know, if you can kind of just do a overview of catching us up. I know you said that the actual trial starts in February, and then we have these other pretrial hearings. I know that there's some level of a gag order, and you act as a paralegal with Tony Serra, Bear's lawyer, and I guess that means that the gag order doesn't affect you, and you can talk more freely than the lawyers. Is that right?
I'm not violating the gag order, even though I'm specifically mentioned as a paralegal with the secretarial staff and other people involved with both law firms. Phil DeJong is an attorney of record there in Ukiah, and Tony Serra is a pro bono attorney that, yes, I have a consultative relationship to for a number of years. But the gag order specifically talks about pejorative information and things that would be outside of the normal limits of talking about cases like this anyway. And so the fact that there is a gag order, it indicates that the county doesn't really want us to address some of the racial class issues, some of the racial attitudes, some of the background of the case, the relationship of the police department to the old guard, if you will, at the Round Valley Reservation, or any of the other relationships of Mendocino County Sheriff's Department to reservations and rancherias in Mendocino County. You know, there's at least 14 places in Mendocino County that are Indian land, and about 10 of those are federally recognized Indian reservations and rancherias. And that means that there's a certain standard with Public Law 280 for the county law enforcement to negotiate contracts and try to make negotiations and have memorandums of agreement on file with each other. And Mendocino County is in violation of federal law, Public Law 280. But that's nothing new. Every county in California, every sheriff's department in California violates this law and do whatever they want to do on the reservation. They interpret it to just go in like gangbusters and do whatever they want to do. An example of this is the search that was conducted for Bear Lincoln during the time that he was evading them because they had threatened to shoot to kill him. And so he was afraid for his life, and the sheriff's department violated procedures and civil law, at least in searching for Bear Lincoln, not only at Round Valley and several other rancherias in Mendocino County. And in fact, next Friday in federal court in the Bay Area, there will be a hearing on the civil rights lawsuit against Mendocino County, and that will be Friday morning in the San Francisco Bay Area in federal court. So there's a civil rights complaint by the Native American residents of Round Valley and some of the other rancherias against the Mendocino County Sheriff's Department because they barged in and they, without search warrants, and they held guns to children's heads, and they ordered elders out of their homes, and they stopped cars on the road and made people lie on the pavement. It was a reign of terror against the Native American community, and especially the poverty community, if you drive an old car or such. During that time, and during the next few weeks and months until Bear Lincoln surrendered in and came in and turned himself into the authorities at Tony Serra's office in San Francisco in order to vindicate the death of Acorn Peters, and in order to show that he's truly not guilty.
Yeah, it seems like the evidence against Bear is very slim. Well, there, since then, more recently, there's been another incident out in Covelo concerning the tribal office and stuff like that. We had a little bit of that on this show. Actually, I'm going to ask you about it in 1 minute, but we got somebody trying to call in, so let me take them and see if it's a question for you. And so hold on a sec. I'll put you both on the air together.
Okay.
Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, is this Judy?
Yeah.
Hey, Judy, this is Josh.
Hey, Josh, you know what? We're not quite finished. Can you call me back in 5 minutes?
Yeah, no problem.
Okay, thanks a whole lot.
Oh, Josh.
Bye.
Okay. All right, and
recent events,
Wait, hold on one second, Dennis, because there's also somebody else that's been waiting for a very long time that I think has a very short announcement, and then we'll get into this other subject. So, okay. Oh, shoot. We really blew it there because we lost Dennis. I hope that he'll call us back. The one that we were had on hold was Greg Krause from NAW with an announcement about the Garland demo. So I'd like to ask actually either Greg to give us a call back at 895-2448 this time, and we'll get you right on. And hopefully Dennis will call us back because the main thing that he had to tell us about was an upcoming benefit that's in Anderson Valley for Bear Lincoln. So we'll just keep on waiting for those calls. And I don't know, in the meantime, I hate to change the subject and move on to something else. And I'm not like real, real knowledgeable about what's going on. So not hearing from any of them, I'm not sure whether I should move on to another. Oh, here we got one of them. Okay, go ahead. Caller, you're on the air.
Judy, this is Dennis again.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off. Okay, let's get back to where we were, which was
At Round Valley, within the last few weeks, there's been a drama that's unfolded as a result of the traditionals, and the community of Round Valley has finally gotten fed up again, once again, with the old guard, with the old tribal council. And a few weeks ago, they initiated an occupation of the tribal council offices. At the same time, following federal law, they initiated a referendum and got petitions out for re-election. And they had the re-election, and they re-elected a new tribal council. And they filed their papers with the Bureau of Indian Affairs office in Sacramento. And then about 3 weeks ago, on a Friday, the old guard came in and the old tribal chairman came in and tried to get the Mendocino County Sheriff to evict the occupiers.
Now, the occupiers were people who, I guess I'll describe the Lincoln family as the traditionalists. So the occupiers were the traditionalists and people associated with the Lincoln family. And as I understand
I think, Judy, that it's a mistake to try to identify too much with any one family in the Round Valley situation or with Native Americans generally. But there were Hoaglands and Peters and Britons and Lincolns and Asbills and many others that are part of the referendum and the petition.
Oh, that's interesting, because that kind of goes...
Just to think about it a little bit now, Judy. With 376 voters that are 18 and over on the Round Valley Reservation, they got over 170 signatures on a petition from their own tribal enrollment, from their own citizenship of people that are eligible to vote for the tribal council Democratic election. So they received over 50% of the support from the residents of the Indian Reservation there at the Round Valley Confederated Tribes. So there were many, many families involved, and it's hard to point out how many of those families are what names. So I just wanted...
Okay, I'm sorry. You know, I think that's a really good point, and it is. You just kind of get swept into these stereotypes.
Exactly. While it's true that there are certain there are certain families and certain individuals that are trying to bring to the future the culture of the Native people, that are trying to recover the memories of the elders so that they can perform the songs and the dances and the prayers and the languages. Well, it's true, there's many activities like that on the reservation. It's not just one family that does that. Many of those elders are from many different families, and not just Round Valley. It's all over Northern California. There's been a resurrection, if you will, and a renaissance in the last 30 years. It's been going on along with the political Indian movement, and so we just many of those families from they still try to practice their culture. An example of that would be this weekend on Saturday morning. The youth and young people of Round Valley are running from Round Valley Reservation all the way on the Dos Rios Road to Laytonville, on the Branscombe Road to the ocean, up Highway 1 to the Usal Road, where they will encamp in the Sinkayon Wilderness area this weekend. And that run has been a way for them to instill pride in their culture and heritage of the youth, and also to take elders. They drive elders over there, and the elders show the youth some of the different herbs and plants and things that they made from the land in an area that is close to the coast. And of course, they go surf fishing, and they do all kinds of things that they teach the youth about their culture that way. And this is an activity this weekend is going on that just is a perfect example of that.
Okay, hold on. I got a caller. I'm going to put him on the air, and then I'll have you announce the time and everything for the weekend event. Hold on.
Okay.
Okay, caller, you're on the air.
I was calling. Somebody called me and told me to call because we just were over the All Species Grove yesterday.
Uh-huh.
In an aircraft.
Oh, okay. Well, can I just ask you to hold on for a second and let the person who's on now finish up, because he's doing with a different subject. So just hang on. And Dennis, what I'd like you to do is tell us the details of the benefit.
First of all, I want to encourage all of you that are protecting the headwaters out there, and I think that's a very important. That's one of the most crucial struggles in the whole country today. With my opinion of it is that Horowitz to do time before there's any justice at all in this situation. But we're coming to Anderson Valley, and we're glad to be on KZYX today because we're coming to Anderson Valley next weekend with a benefit for Bear Lincoln at the Anderson Valley Grange Hall. And we have some very wonderful entertainment, Frida Circus, all-women jazz-based rhythm and blues who describe themselves as gypsies that play soul. We have the Black Horse Blues Band, Pomo Indian tunes to new chords and old drum beats, and it's Pomos and non-Indians together in a blues band. Mitchell Holman, all-around virtuoso, will perform solo, and we're looking forward to that. And we'll, of course, open with a traditional drum, the Kasha drum. Of course, the purpose of what we want to do is to outline and give flesh out our perspective of what Bear Lincoln's personality is. We'd like you to get to know what he's like. We're going to show a slideshow from the Plenty Organization, a national bioregional organization that Bear worked under contract for, and a slideshow of Bear Lincoln and some comments about him and what he's like. Phil DeJong, the attorney of record, will address issues surrounding the case. And Edwina Lincoln, Bear's in-law, she'll address recent events that happened on the Round Valley Reservation before the performance.
Okay, Dennis, will you tell us one more time what's the time? You said it's at the Anderson Valley Grange, and tell the time and date one more time.
It's going to be the Anderson Valley Grange Hall on next Friday night. That's next Friday night, 25th of October, 1996, from 7 p.m. until midnight at the Anderson Valley Grange Hall, Highway 128 between Boonville and Philo. Respect for Mother Earth and each other. No alcohol or drugs. It's a benefit, and we're keeping it low. It's only about $3 at the door, but we'll be passing the hat. So we thank you for letting us be on the air, and we'll be glad to be on the air again.
Okay, thanks.
And see you next week.
Yeah, why don't you call in a reminder next week? Thanks a whole lot.
I will.
Okay, good. All right, that was Dennis Jennings, the paralegal for Tony Serra, representing Bear Lincoln in the Covelo case. And, okay, caller, are you still there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes, I'm here. Are you ready to change subjects?
Yeah, well, we're done now. We're moving on. We got another call, which I think is Josh. So hold on again, and we'll have you both on at the same, and you can give yours, and then he'll give his. So one sec. Okay, caller, you're on the air?
Hi, Judy. I have Howard on the line.
Oh, well, that's great. Okay, so, well, let's get the guy who's been waiting patiently and put Howard on, and we'll let him wait, too. So, okay, caller who did the flyover.
Yeah. We're wanting to know what it looked like today, perhaps?
Yeah, sure do.
Yeah, well, they're...
Are they still salvage logging in the rain?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm not sure if they're salvage logging in the rain. It hadn't started raining yesterday when we flew over.
Okay.
But they were very busy there, obviously. And what we saw was, you know, it didn't look very good. They seem to be taking it as, you know, everything on the ground as fast as possible. And I know they can't cut the trees down, but, you know, what they're doing there, the trees, a lot of them are probably going to fall down this winter. They're taking out so much of the roots and everything of the trees. They're pulling the trees from around. It's kind of crazy. They're using the large cats to drag the trees out from underneath them. And what's happening to the topsoil there is extremely harsh.
Well, we saw a picture in the Press Democrat that showed these just wide gouges going straight down. But what you couldn't tell from the Press Democrat is how extensive this was. How big of an area are they doing this in?
Well, the kind of picture that you saw in the Press Democrat was some of the residual forest where a lot of pampas grass had come back and everything. There are some really extensive areas of that. I was pretty surprised at how much of that there was. A lot of it, the entire hillside, the only topsoil left is like little tiny eye-shaped islands where there's one old-growth stump, and that seems to be sitting 6-8 feet above the surrounding land where I'm not sure what they've done there, but some of it's devoid of even a twig or a stick of any kind. All you can see is dirt. That's probably 75% of the actual surface area. It looks sort of like a Celtic knot from up above.
Wow. That sounds pretty bad. Okay, well, we got one of the lockdowners on the other line, so if you... Okay, so I think I'll move on?
Sure.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye.
Okay. Okay, so now I think we have on the line Howard Faulkner.
Hello.
Hey, Howard. Well, gee. Welcome back. Howard, as I told you earlier in the show, is from Willits, is an ex-logger, and was locked to a bulldozer in All Species Grove last week. So why don't you start by telling us what made you do that?
Well, you know what has to be done. I mean, you know, they've gone crazy out there. He's talking about all the skid trails and stuff, the dirt, the tore-up dirt. There's no, you know, anything left growing on the ground. Everything's about a foot and a half deep in dust. I mean, you know, when we walk down in there, it's pretty bad. I mean, you know, it's just real bad down up there. They're doing a really quick, nasty, as fast as they can job.
And that's not surprising, being MaxSam. Can you describe what you did? What did, you know, the people, I heard 30 people sat down and stuff like that. Where was it? I heard it might have been at a bridge. Just describe the action.
Okay, well, we came down. I'm not going to say where we came down from, but we came down about 3 o'clock in the morning, came down all the way down the hill, down to the river, to where a landing was at, where two bulldozers and a loader were located in a security yard. We came down approximately 5 o'clock, walked around the corner, confronted the security guard, who went completely ape, swinging his stick, poking people in the ribs, hit Josh in the eye. I mean, he was real, real, real harsh.
Was this a PL security, or was it one of the hired firms?
This PL security. He hit Josh in the eye with his cane. He poked people in the ribs. My support person, I got to say, was one of the most wonderful young men I ever met. He stood there and put his body in our way. I was locked with another young lady on the loader, and he put himself right in the way and wouldn't let the man touch him. Us. Support was excellent. I mean, everything went off pretty good. I mean, the guy was terrified. I mean, 35 people come walking out of the middle of the dark, you know, with no flashlights and say, "Hi, here we are." I mean, it scared him pretty good.
Wow, that's amazing.
Well, everybody got, you know, they cooled him down. It took about a half hour for him to cool down. He left our support people in place with the people that were locked down until the sheriff came. The loggers were pretty belligerent, especially when I told them that I was a faller.
Oh, that made them madder, huh?
Oh, they picked up a rock and were going to throw it at me because I told them that I was an LP faller, and they asked me what I was doing under there, and I... some kind of dialogue with them, but the only thing they were interested in is why I was such a turncoat.
Are they unaware of what LP has done and how many people they've laid off?
Well, they really wouldn't let me say much to them. They were being pretty vocal about how they thought I was some kind of so-and-so for, you know, getting under a loader and, you know, from being a faller to getting under a loader and locking to it.
And that's kind of different from the experience we've had. I mean, we probably wouldn't even know you if loggers in this county had that attitude towards what's going on. That's a kind of surprising one to hear.
Yeah, I was really surprised too, because I mean, those people are beating themselves out of a job. They don't seem to realize that as soon as they're done, they're going to be laid off in the unemployment dole, and then the welfare reform's going to kick them, and then they ain't going to have nothing but a place out on the street along with the rest of us.
Really? That's true. Hold on one sec, because I got another caller, Karn, to come in, so one sec. Okay, caller, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Josh.
Josh, we got Howard Faulkner on the other line.
You got who on the other line?
Howard, your fellow demonstrator.
Yeah.
I don't think these two people have seen each other since jail yesterday. Josh, just to explain for people who are listening to this, Josh was one of the other people on the action, and Howard just described Josh getting hit with a nightstick or something of that effect. You want to pick up that story, Josh?
Yeah, well, we were out there doing support for the action while six very brave people were locked down to the equipment. There was a group of us who were there to ensure their safety, to make sure that they weren't getting beat up or, you know, that they had all their needs taken care of. And there was a very irate security guard out there. I would describe him as borderline psychotic. We got out there. He would not calm down. He was swearing, being verbally abusive as well as physically abusive. He hit a number of us with his nightstick, including me, right above the right eye on the forehead. And kind of a hard blow. I was knocked to the ground. My glasses were knocked off. I'm all right now, but it was borderline. It could have been a borderline serious injury.
And you ended up in jail. I don't know that you were planning. Howard, you were planning on getting arrested, right?
Oh, of course.
This was the first time you ever did that. Isn't that true?
It's the first time I've been arrested. Most of the time, I've just been behind the scenes.
Yeah, I know you've been around for a while. The decision to get arrested, I mean, was that a shocking thing to see how they treated the arrestees, or is that pretty much what you expected?
I was very surprised at the security guard. I really thought that they would have a little more professional, you know, attitude and comport themselves in a, you know, a more professional manner instead of going around swinging the stick and calling everything except something good to eat. Basically, he was very upset. I think he was pretty scared myself. I thought our support was you just cannot beat a better group of people.
Josh, go ahead.
Yeah, it really did test our limits in terms of trying to maintain a nonviolent atmosphere. We repeatedly said, we're nonviolent, we're not here to hurt you, we're not here to hurt the equipment, we're just here to keep it from moving for the next few hours. And usually folks in that situation see that and take a minute and calm down, and the situation, you know, stabilizes. But in this case, he kept going. he was out of control, and we really feared for our lives, and we're actually very fortunate that he did not have a firearm nearby. And we're actually pretty lucky that he didn't have a heart attack, too, at the same time. He was.
Wow. So there was, ended up, I don't know how much it was, 13 people arrested or something like that. How long did you shut the job? How long were you locked down? And, Howard, what were you locked down with? Describe how you were in relation to the loader.
I was pretty much underneath the rear tire, kind of leaning against it and partially underneath it a little while. We were right next to where the thing articulates, you know, where the loader, you know, whenever a loader turns, you know, the body is segmented so that it turns, and we were close to that anchor point where it, you know, where it pivots, and so they couldn't get at us for a while, and I guess we were there for approximately 3.5 hours.
Oh, that's great. Okay, so then you all got taken off to jail. How'd they take you off to jail? That was a ways in, huh, that hike?
Oh, yeah, they took us all off in a van after they got everybody, you know, taken apart. I mean, they had to take a ram off of one of the blades to get one man out. There was several people, you know, non-compliant people that really did a real good job verbally thrashing them, I thought. But, you know, we were taken in a van, taken to jail.
Yeah, you've been in jail, what, 5 days for some misdemeanor? What was that like in jail, Josh?
Who are you talking to?
I was going to actually give Josh a chance.
Jail, it wasn't actually that bad. They housed us basically all together. I know you, Howard, were housed in a different cell, but with other Earth Firsters, though.
Right. Yeah,
the system actually worked this time in a certain sense. We got arraigned within 48 hours and were released last night, which is kind of a different from the norm because most Earth Firsters lately have been kept in for 5 or 6 days, denied OR the first time around, and treated very harshly in jail, denied a lot of things. But they seem to be coming around and recognizing that we have our act together and that we're actually holding them to the law in many senses, and they're starting to react, I think, in a certain way, realizing that they can't play these games with us much longer.
Hey, and Howard, how was that for you being in jail?
Well, I didn't really have too much problem with it. I was with the people who had started a hunger strike, and of course, I just fell in right in line with them.
Were you on a hunger strike, Howard?
I stayed with solidarity with the men that were in the jail and didn't eat because,
not much to eat anyway.
they aren't eating, so I wasn't eating either. I did finally break down after 48 hours, so I was hungry. But they were on a different action. They were very, very good spirits. Everybody in there is doing real well. The jail people seem to know the distinction between the people that they're arresting off the streets and us. But they, down in booking, I thought they were being pretty harsh, nailing people that were, one lady got up and just got a sweatshirt and they locked her down.
Mm.
And got up, changed the channel, and they locked her down. So, they played their little games. But other than that, I thought it was pretty mellow.
Okay, I need to say that the time is now 1 o'clock, and you're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM, Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM, Willetson, Ukiah, and K202BE, Fort Bragg at 88.3 FM. This is the Punch and Judy Show. This is your host, Judy Berry. And, I'm really sorry because I didn't expect to have you all both on at once, which is terrific. But I actually have another interview scheduled for the end of this show, so maybe I can have you come back again next week and give us some more of the details. But what, Josh, I'd want to ask you to announce what's going on in the next couple days up there.
Well, we have 3 rallies in 3 days coming up. I know Sunday at noon in Arcata there is a rally for the Headwaters Forest. And I know on Monday there is a rally at the California Department of Forestry. And I'm not sure what time that begins. And then Tuesday we have a critical mass bike ride starting in Arcata. But there's a rally in Arcata on Sunday again is a big one. We hope to have people from all over Mendocino and Humboldt County there to again rally against salvage logging, to let the powers that be know that this deal is not a deal and that the ancient forest is still falling in many different ways, that we need to stop this to save headwaters.
And now, and the Arcata rally is at 12 noon. There's somebody who's offering to drive a bus from Willits to that rally if there's 15 or 20 people who want to go. So if you want to ride the bus, be picked up at the Willits Environmental Center, then please call 459-4110 and let them know. And if we got enough people, we got a ride.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. I'm glad to see there's some busing and carpooling happening for that. That's what it's all about. But yeah, folks can come out Sunday and show, again, their support for the Headwaters. We need to keep doing this. We need to keep the pressure up, and that's part of what us being out in the woods is all about, is showing resistance to the salvage logging and the continued destruction of the Headwaters. But people who can't get in the woods, going to rallies, coming to the California Department of Forestry, that's where they can fit in and be a part of this, and we really need you.
Okay, well, that's great. Thanks for coming on, and I want to have you on when we have a little more time. Hopefully, the time fills up in the show so fast.
And next week, there'll be much more to tell. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, great. Yeah, and that one at the CDF ought to be fun, too. The next day, they're kind of nervous, I think, at the California Department of Forestry, feeling guilty for what they've done. So, Howard, you got a few last words for us?
No,
okay.
I'll come on next week. I'm trying to word a statement to people who log so that they can get the message a little more clearly.
Oh, that'd be great.
Oh, I'll have something like that for you next week.
Okay, good. Well, we'll definitely have you both on, and thanks a lot for your reports.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So that was Josh Brown from Arcata and Howard Faulkner from Willits with a first-hand report on the actions. Now, what I have scheduled for this part of the show, I think that what we're doing is so incredible, I find myself saying, well, we're the most important anti-corporate prolonged campaign in the United States. And I'm going, I wonder if that's really true. Are we getting a little bit myopic here? Because we know other people don't hear about what we're doing, and we really don't hear that much about what other people are doing. So I do know of one other pretty long-term anti-corporate struggle going on right now, and that's the Detroit newspaper strike. So I checked in with some of the strikers and found out that they have quite a bit to report also. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to put on some music while I make a call to Detroit, and we'll be talking to one of the Detroit newspaper strikers and seeing the incredible parallels between the struggles, the tactics, and the attitudes. And the music I'm going to put on is from Daryl's new CD, the If a Tree Falls, and this is not actually all by Daryl. It's a compilation CD with a lot of different singers and songwriters on it. I'm sure you've been hearing a lot of it's been played. But there's this one song that people don't play very much. It's one of my favorite ones, and it's Farewell to Clickwet Sound. And it's, I guess it violates the verbal nonviolence code or something. It says blow the bridge down. It doesn't say blow the bridge up. It says blow the bridge down. But for some people are avoiding the song, even though I think we're talking about a poetic metaphor here. So I'm going to put this song on, and I'm going to make this call, and then we'll be back. And this is, I think this is a really one of the best songs on the CD. So don't freak out if it says blow the bridge down. It's not blow the bridge up.
On Vancouver Island, for her so old, the last of her kind, she is mighty and bold. But the big blades now are mowing her down. Farewell, farewell to Clackwood Sound. Well, the NDP had made a big noise, trying to play the big games with all the big boys. So they sold out her soul for hardly a cent. The raw timber's cut and elsewhere is sent. To blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of backward sound. Take a deep breath and blow the bridge down. Upwards of thousands have stood in the way, but police just come and take them each day. And the government too has its own solve, the change in the charges by change in the law. So blow the bridge down, blow the bridge down in the dead of the night. Sink it into the ground for the sake of the soul of Clackwood Sound.
Okay, this is Judy, and I'm back, and I have on the phone with me Rebecca Cook. Rebecca? Oops, wait a minute. Okay, now, Rebecca.
Hi, Judy.
Okay, great. Before we get started, I got past that. This is, I think, the most crowded show I've ever had. Both lines have been just ringing off the hook the whole time. Somebody faxed this in, and I need to announce it because this person was trying to get in and failed to, is that there will be a Caltrans herbicide demo in Casper at 1 p.m. this Saturday. I'm sorry, from noon to 1 p.m. this Saturday. Meet at Jug Handle parking lot before 12 noon, and that's tomorrow. As you all probably know, Caltrans is resuming herbicide spraying on the sides of the roads, and people are going to go out there and do something about it. So make sure you can make it there. Jug Handle parking lot at 12 noon tomorrow. Okay, so now on to you, Rebecca. Rebecca is one of the long-term strikers from the Detroit newspaper strike. And Rebecca, why don't you start by just kind of saying who you are. What did you do in the newspaper business before you went on strike?
Well, let's see. I'm a news photographer, and I shoot sports and news. And I still do. Now I'm just a freelancer. But up until July 15th, 1995, I worked at the which is one of the two major dailies in Detroit. Both papers are on strike, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News.
Okay, for some reason your voice faded out there for a second. She just said she worked for the Detroit News as opposed to it. Now, this strike has been going on for a long time. When did it start?
Well, we're going on our 15th month. We walked out of the building at 8 p.m. July 13, 1995.
Wow. Okay, and so what brought on the strike? What made you all go out?
Okay, the reason that 2,500 workers walked out, and many have having had 30 to 35 years with the company, is we're charging, this is an unfair labor practice strike, which means the company provoked the strike by bad faith bargaining and basically refusing to bargain with us, which they are supposed to do by law. And in fact, we've been in the NLRB courts with this all along, and they just closed arguments a few weeks ago, and now it would take a few months for the lawyers to file, you know, to write their briefs and then for the judge to read it. And we expect some kind of an answer in the spring, or maybe around January.
So what they actually did, though, is they just decided that your contract didn't count anymore. Is that right?
Well, we believe the company, and we believe we've proved this in court, that Gannett owns the Detroit News, Knight Ritter owns the Free Press, that they started setting up this strike to break our union, and they started at least several years ago. They signed a joint operating agreement in 1989, and we think that was the beginning of their plan. And, of course, by busting the union in Detroit, then that pretty much sends a message across the country.
Well, boy, Detroit definitely is one of the most well-known union towns in the country, and if they can do it there, then nobody's going to be safe.
You're right.
Now, Gannett is, that may not be as familiar to people. Gannett is the owner of USA Today, not so it's kind of a, we're kind of an evil company to start with.
Yeah, Gannett has a bad reputation when it comes to unions to begin with. And yes, Gannett owns USA Today. They're located in Virginia, and they also own about 90 other papers across the country and radio stations and TV stations.
And Knight Ritter, how about them?
Knight Ritter runs second to Gannett in ownership. So what you have now, these two companies together make the largest media conglomerate in the world. And that's a lot of what we're saying, is not only, once you break our union, if you do, which we don't believe they will, this is a terrible fight, but we're in it, a lot of question is, I mean, we have hard enough time, you know, you don't have problems keeping me honest in this business. It's keeping the guys on top honest. And what kind of coverage does the average person really think they're going to get when it comes to labor or human issues in this country? It's going to be nilcho.
Right, it's almost nilcho already.
Right.
Well, okay, so now you said 2,500 people went on strike, but was there a particular provocation that made the 2,500 people walk out on July 13th?
Right, when our contract ended at the end of April, that both sides went to the table, and the company immediately sat down and demanded concessions from. So we have six unions that work at both papers, and that includes the Guild, which is us editorial. Then you have the Teamsters, who are the drivers. You have typographical. Well, the first thing they asked for were things like eliminating full-time jobs, turning them into part-time jobs. They demanded from us merit pay. The big thing for the Guild was merit pay raises only, no across the board, which means you were at the mercy of your boss. Which meant if your boss liked your face, you got a raise. If your boss didn't like your face, you never got a raise.
Or even more so, if you wrote what your boss wanted you to write instead of what really happened, then you might get your raise.
Well, and that's a big problem that we have already, and if it wasn't for the union, you know, in many ways. I've seen writers fight for what they believe in, and you had that little bit of edge to cover you. Well, that would be gone completely. And in fact, what's interesting, the replacement scabs that they've brought in from all over the country to replace us inside the buildings, and they've brought them from small little tiny Gannett Knight Ritter papers, we keep track of all the errors of what goes in the paper. The writing is so pathetic. They've made so many major errors. And can I give you an example of two of them?
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay, one, we had a congresswoman here running for office, and she was quoted, and this was in the Free Press, as saying that I hate the white race. Well, it was quoted before the election. She said, I never said this. The Free Press stood behind their scab reporter and said, you said it, we stand behind that reporter. Well, after the election and after she lost, they double-checked and found out, in fact, she had not said that, and they had to run a front-page correction.
A little late for that.
Yeah, a little late. We in the same paper did another I don't remember the exact quote. They quoted someone out in, it might have been someone who was selling real estate, something like that, who said something to the effect of, if black people move in here, I'm going to chop them up into pieces and kill them. Kind of a, like a horrible quote.
Jeez.
Yeah, I mean like a really horrible quote thing. What happened, that particular person, someone attacked them and beat them so badly they were put in the hospital. And this was right after that quote ran in the paper. And then once again, they had to run a front page correction.
Those are incredible examples. I want to just give a little local context here so that people can understand how important newspaper unions are, even to those of us who don't work at newspapers. I'm sure a lot of people who listen to this show remember that in 1990, Mike Janella, the top timber reporter in this area, was removed from his job as timber reporter for daring to report a little piece of the truth. You won't find too much of that in Mike's reporting anymore. But at any rate, he had written some pretty good articles about what was going on in the struggle, and the editors took him off the timber beat. Now, there's a reason why they didn't fire him, and the reason they didn't fire him is because he had a union job in the same union that Rebecca is in, and that union protected his job, and they weren't allowed to just get rid of him. All they could do was prevent him from covering timber in an area where that's all that's happening. And so he just kind of bided his time and waited it out until they finally started letting him cover timber again. But I want to point out that without the union, they could have simply fired him, and although he's definitely cowed from what he used to be, he still occasionally gets in something, and at least he understands the issue. So this isn't something that just happens in Detroit. This is something that happens here, and it affects us all. Rebecca, I wanted to ask you to describe the strike tactics, because that's what's been really striking, striking, weird word for that, but anyway, that's been kind of inspiring. We're in a direct action movement here where we chain ourselves to things and get arrested and all, and that sounds like a lot of the same kind of tactics you all are using.
Well, actually, see, I keep tabs on a lot of what's going on, and I do get little snippets now and then of what you all are doing out there on your neck of the woods. And so I find that interesting. And ours is probably very much similar. And something that happened very unique, what we all turned around, when we walked out of that building, we called it the Great Equalizer. You had high-powered columnists walking next to maintenance, walking next to drivers, walking next to everybody. And pretty soon everybody was the same. No one had a paycheck anymore. And what I found amazing, people who had never been political before and never been activists, this company turned them into activists. You now have 2,000 people still left out. And a lot of the things people found themselves doing, we did similar things. First, we had major pickets. And we had incredible community support that the company never counted on, because they have such contempt for their own community. They didn't believe people would come out. So we would get 2,000 people to show up along with us, and we would go down to the printing plant, and we would stage all-night-long pickets. We'd take sleeping bags, food, whatever we had to take.
With thousands of people.
Yeah, exactly. And we were calling it some kind of, I forget, we had a funny name for it, some Woodstock picnic name. And these are folks, I mean, you might have had some old guy who'd lived in the suburbs, who worked at the company 35 years running a press, who never would have been involved in anything like this before, who now is radicalized. So now we're out there, and we would spend all night long sitting in the driveway to keep the trucks from coming out. And what the company did was they basically bought off the police departments. We have the documents to show. They've given up to now up close to $2 million to Sterling Heights Police to buy all their riot gear and pay their overtime. And throughout the night, when the trucks would come out, these police would come across in their riot gear and attack our strike lines. And I've been photographing a strike from day one. I see old men, I see women, I see all kinds of folks fighting back with no weapons, just their picket signs in their hands as they're being clubbed by police. And that's when the company talks about violence, where the violence was put upon us. We didn't put it upon someone else.
Yeah, that tends to be the tactics. Now, I know you talked before about that not just the security guards and the police coming out, but also trucks trying to run you down.
I was never raised in a bubble, and I've been fortunate that I've seen many things on this planet, but that was probably one of the most depressing nights of my life, when I realized my life was worth $1.50 Sunday paper. We had picketed peacefully all night long, and we were sitting around about 3 or 4 in the morning. You're all kind of tired. And next thing you know, we look across the street, and the police, who were just across the street, stand up in their riot gear, which usually means they were going to come across and snatch a few folk or club a few folk or mace someone. So we had our backs turned to the plant. we were out at the printing plant. And the gates opened. We had no warning whatsoever. We heard screams, and there were, I forget how many semis or small, those small trucks came barreling out of the plant directly towards us. And they did not stop. They didn't brake. They just plowed right through our picket line. People started screaming, crying, jumping out of the way. I started shooting pictures, and in my mind, as the dust settled, as the trucks zoomed off, I thought, my next shot is going to be someone, you know, dead that I know. Well, we couldn't believe no one had been hit. It was some kind of little miracle that happened that night. The police stood across the street, and they watched those trucks take off. And see, they keep radio contact, the police and the guards, the hired Detroit newspaper guards, so they know what's going on. And that night, we all stood and stared at each other, and it was like this total calm and total quiet when we realized they were willing to kill us.
Yeah, we've actually had to have that realization here, too. You'd mentioned the security guards, and these aren't just any old security guards. This is a kind of a famous company.
This is called, like a real wake-up call for a lot of Americans. They're called Vance Security, started by Charles Vance, ex-son-in-law of Gerald Ford. And Vance, they got their training down in the Pitson strike, and we spoke with a lot of folks who'd been from down there, and they would beat up and intimidate and threaten strikers. They're trained for violence. They have full riot gear. When you read their ads, in fact, Covert Action did a story on the Mike Zelinsky about maybe in the spring there was a story, and part of their advertising to company is, we will get your people to do whatever they're supposed to do. We'll videotape it so you can get injunctions. And they're legal. They're completely legal. They are now being hired. And you know what they're also doing? They're also buying up the market in Canada and Mexico as their laws change.
So, okay, so what you're saying is these guards will provoke a situation that can be videotaped and used to take to court to get an injunction against the picketers.
Exactly, and they will do anything possible to incite you. Or they constantly videotape. Here we are, peacefully picket. They will constantly videotape you at all times. They will call you names when no one else is around. Oh, they came out. We have a lucky thing for us. They attacked our people regularly, but it was a matter of who people believe them and don't believe us. Well, one of our councilwomen, Marianne Mahaffey, she's the first person that came out. She's about 60 years old, maybe a bit above. She stayed out all night long with us on a picket line at one of the sites. Her husband was picketing. It was just peaceful pickets. The guards came out and attacked people, clubbed people, and her husband was one of them. And that's how we finally got people to believe and understand what was happening to us. And if it hadn't been for that, once again, it would have been their word against ours.
And which is one of the reasons that it's so important to have community support for this kind of struggle. Unfortunately, we only have 10 minutes left. Boy, the show zooms by each week. But anyway, I want to mention a few of the other tactics because I think it will really strike a chord with people here. One of the things you told me about was simultaneous shutdown of various offices of the suburban bureaus. Will you describe that?
Yeah, what we have going, and remember, the company has filed RICO suits against us, and they filed, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Sorry, you went indulge for a moment. The company has filed a RICO suit against us and against the UAW and other groups. That's part of their tactics to try to shut us down. So in the meantime, community groups have formed their own group. We've had Friends of Labor, we've had Readers Before Profits, and they are organizing these particular civil disobedience. We've had probably 350 acts of civil disobedience since spring by these groups. One just happened a couple days ago where, was it five groups of 10 people, which included strikers and strike supporters, went to five different suburban bureaus of the Detroit News and Free Press and merely walked in the door, because the door is wide open, and sat down and said hi to the scabs and said, we want to discuss with you why you came and you stole jobs that weren't yours. And what happened was, at the same time while this was happening, outside people were calling in the phone lines, tying the lines up, and they faxed in us about 100-page letters from that Martin Luther King had wrote from jail. And so this was all going out at the same time. And then at the same time, eventually the police arrived, and eventually there were arrests. But it tied up those offices, and it let people know the strike wasn't over. And it let these young scabs know in these different bureaus that, you know, because oftentimes they're put out there, and they said, you don't have to cross the picket line, that you have crossed the picket line.
Oh, that sounds like a really great action. Oh, there's also been, you know, we've had some celebrity arrests here. You've had your own kind of celebrity arrests. The new head of the AFL-CIO, I was kind of disappointed when I heard him talking about supporting the Democrats, but it sounds like he's also ready to get out there and do it himself and support your strike. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, we had the day, Labor Day weekend, Sweeney, Trumka, Linda Chavez-Thomas came to town, and they stood in front of the news building.
Well, I'm sorry, some of the people in this audience, we live in a very non-union area. Unfortunately, the unions here, many of them have been smashed, so there's not people all as educated. Will you tell who those people are?
Sorry, yeah, I grew up in Detroit, so I think the whole world is like Detroit. Even though I've traveled the whole world, Sweeney is the newly elected head of the AFL, and Rich Trumka, he is the secretary, and he was also, he's president of the mine workers. He's a fabulous guy if you've ever met him. And then Linda Chavez-Thomas, this was a slate that ran, and that what their part of the AFL was, they started new programs to help up what unions are and help up the labor movement in this country, and which actually they have said they were going to take it to the streets, take it back to where they have to take it. And because of the labor laws and what's happening to people in this country being set back year after year.
And so that's what they did. How did they get arrested? What was that demonstration?
Well, they did a couple hundred people came and picketed in front of the news building. And it's interesting, the police show up. It's the same old thing. And they went and stood up in front of the news building and just front of the doors. And they gave speeches and they let people know we're here to stay and we're not leaving. Well, because part of what the company has against us are injunctions and RICO suits that saying we aren't allowed to block the doors. So they merely sat down in front of the doors and said, we're not moving. So then the police had to come up and arrest maybe about 12 people, while 200 other people sat around, strikers and supporters, and said, arrest us too. But then what happened was the police told the strikers, they said they didn't want to arrest them. They said, we don't want to do the paperwork. It's Labor Day weekend. So they ended up arresting just the celebrities. And then the strikers basically were said, we'll be back another day to be arrested because the police weren't going to arrest them.
So have people basically defied the injunctions then?
Well, yes, you can say the company saying that we defied it. Okay, while they probably has been defied, we aren't using that word.
You're just kind of going around the edge of it.
We're doing it anyways.
All right.
Words. And because you have to. Because if you do what the law says or what the company says you can do, then you may as well just give up because there's nothing you can do.
Because the bosses wrote the laws to make sure you couldn't use any effective strike tactics.
I want to tell you about one of our people on strike, Susan Watson. Susan Watson worked at the Free Press for 30 years. She was the first woman, first black person hired on either paper as a columnist. They just fired her. She's one of our strikers. She sat down that day with Sweeney and Trumka. And she sat down, she was not arrested, and she received a terse little letter. They've now started firing us. I've been fired too. About 100 and some letters came out saying you've been fired for your behavior. She was fired for sitting down in front of Detroit News. Now, Susan has been someone who spoke out for people for many years doing the very same thing. And that's just letting you know the arrogance of this company, that they don't want people to come in who are good people. You're to be a yes person.
Yeah. Well, now, of course, one of the interesting things about being a newspaper strike is you're not going to get very good newspaper coverage for it. And, of course, we've seen little, if any, of this in our papers. But you all started your own paper, kind of like they did. People who've listened to the show for a long time may remember we covered the San Francisco newspaper strike. And they had a strike newspaper. Will you tell us about yours?
Yeah, our paper has been completely unique. It's called the Detroit Sunday Journal. And under our masthead, it says a publication of striking Detroit newspaper workers. And it's the reason all of us went into journalism, this paper. We combined all of our efforts. We don't get paychecks for this, but it's considered part of our strike duties, those of us who do it. You have the editorials, you have the photographer, you have the Teamsters who are on strike, they're the drivers, we have deliverers, and we put out our own newspaper. We borrowed the money to buy computers. We rented a small little location downtown Detroit, and we put it out every Sunday. We have advertisers. And it's a tabloid side. And so far, we've gotten rave reviews. People have come in from all over the country. We had a TV crew come in from Paris, you know, to do a story on us. And also, what's really irritated both scab papers is our paper has regularly scooped them on stories that they can't even touch.
That's great. And I think this is the same thing that's happening here. All the good reporters, all the good columnists, all the good photographers were on strike. And so the paper, of course, was better. You know, we only got two more minutes now, Rebecca. I want to give you a chance to tell people how to subscribe to the Strike Paper and how we can send to support. Is there phone numbers to call? Is there a place we can send money? Will you give us that information?
Yeah, let me give you phone number and address, and then you can do either of the above with it. It's called the Detroit Sunday Journal, 3100 East Jefferson, Detroit, Michigan, and the zip code is 48207-5052, and our phone number is 313-567-9818. And it's a three-month subscription for $15.
Oh, that's not much.
Yeah, it's not much at all, and it's a fabulous paper. And you, and if you call that number or write in, you can find out what you can do, how you can help, how you can be a part of this. And I know we've got people. In fact, we're doing... we have a campaign, actually, people all across the country who have been going to Gannett Papers and Knight Ritter Papers and doing demonstrations in support for us. That's happened at quite a few papers. So there's a lot going on.
Okay, well, it sounds great, and I really wish we had more time because it's really, there's so much to tell. We'll see if we can have you on again and give us a later report, kind of keep in touch with these two struggles.
Well, now that I have your address, I'm going to send off things to you so it's a lot easier. There's a lot to read, there's a lot to know, and there's a lot going on. And like I said, we plan on sticking out the fight.
Okay, and we'll keep in touch with you. I think that these two are kind of parallel movements here, and we should,
Well, if you're on the West Coast and we're over here on the East Coast, somehow we can make it grow and we can meet in the middle.
Sounds great. Okay, thanks for coming on, Rebecca, and I'll talk to you again later.
Okay, bye.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're unfortunately just about out of time on the Punch and Judy Show. The preceding portion of the Punch and Judy Show has been brought to you in part by Mendocino Environmental Center. I also just got a notice to tell you that on Heartbeat Vibrations promo, on the Heartbeat I'm sorry, I think I wasn't supposed to read that title, so much for my professionalism. On Heartbeat Vibrations, on Monday, October 21st at 2:45, Lisa Maldonado of the American Civil Liberty Union Civil Liberties Union will explain why the ACLU opposes Proposition 209, the CCRI ballot initiative. And for those of you who didn't get a chance to listen to Heartbeat Vibrations last Monday for the Anti-Columbus Day show, it was really great. I think Sister Yasmin's doing terrific work in combining both music and the politics that kind of is behind the spirit of that music. So I'd like to recommend for everybody to call in Heartbeat Vibrations or to tune in. Heartbeat Vibrations is at 2 p.m. on Mondays, so keep a touch for that. So that's it for the Punch and Judy Show today. We'll be back again next week, and I stay tuned. I guess I need to tell you one more time, you're listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo and KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Stay tuned now for Counterspin with Lara Flanders.